I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, last week on the show, I showed you what I called at the time the worst example of press release reporting I've ever seen. Well, I stand corrected. Plus, climate scientist Cliff Mast joins us to explain why he is voting yes on the initiative to repeal the Climate Commitment Act. And Coors becomes just the latest company to ditch DEI. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. And I can make a commitment to you, each and every one of you, unless it's not already painfully clear. I will never be a mouthpiece for the government. I will never be a mouthpiece for the government. And you will never see us regurgitate, certainly not verbatim, talking points from the government. Or frankly, from any elected official, any political candidate. Do we support certain political candidates on this show? Yeah, it's an opinion show. I reserve the right to do that. But if they misstep, if they lie, if they don't do what they say they're going to do, you're going to hear us call them out. It is a shocking day for journalism when we have more journalistic ethics than actual newsrooms. You know, I say all the time, and I'll just say it again here. I'll just put it here and somebody, I'll cut it. And then every time somebody says, oh, you're a terrible journalist, I'll post this video next to it. I'm not a journalist. I'm not a journalist. I am not a journalist. I wish I could speak other languages because I would say it in 50 languages. I'm not a journalist. I'm a political commentator. I give my opinion. But we still try to be journalistically accurate. We want to ensure that our opinions are based in truth. And on this show, you have seen several times where I have gotten things wrong and I have come back and corrected them immediately because that's one of the core tenets of being a journalist. But one of the other core tenets of being a journalist is to understand what your primary responsibility to the public is. It's to the truth, yes. It's also to be a check on power. Fundamentally, it's one of the wonderful things about the First Amendment and one of the wonderful things about this country. Is that the media exists to protect people from government abuses, from government lies, misfeasance, malfeasance. That is our fundamental responsibility. So let me spin a little tale for you about something that came up last night as I was sitting at home working frantically, as I often do at night. And I didn't really realize how bad it was until we got in to plan for the show this morning. And Nicole will tell you, God bless Nicole today. I upended our whole show with like 15 minutes left before we came on live. And it's because this is such an egregious example of how the media is letting you down. And how the media is, through either incompetence, laziness, bias, is influencing the outcome of elections. So a couple weeks ago, the Seattle Times did this big expose we talked about on the show about sex offenders in Washington state, and not just any sex offenders, SVPs, sexually violent predators. These are individuals who are deemed so dangerous that after their prison sentence is complete, they're civilly committed to an island, and they're not let off the island unless they can convince a judge that they've been rehabilitated. The Seattle Times article a couple weeks ago was published August 18th. Washington confined hundreds for sexual violence, then it quietly began releasing them. Now, the backdrop of this article is interesting. There had been communities for several years now, Enumclaw, Tenino, that found out that some of these sexually violent predators from McNeil Island were being granted release from civil commitment, and then they were ending up in these less secure facilities, basically glorified houses, in their backyards, down the street from them and their kids. And they were not told about it by the government. And so obviously that was very frustrating for these parents. And they were petitioning lawmakers, please help us do something about this. You know, why are these, you know, violent sex predators being released into our neighborhoods in the first place from McNeil? And if you're going to do it, at least tell us about it. So the Seattle Times article, there was all this history there. And in fact, the Seattle Times had started its reporting on this investigative piece because it was from the Times watchdog several years ago while this was happening in these neighborhoods. So there was a lot to be done on this. It was a very relevant topic. But the thing that got me about the Seattle Times article, which I expressed on the show when it came out, is it's talking about how in the Attorney General's office, which is tasked with keeping these sexually violent predators on McNeil Island, that under the current Attorney General, Bob Ferguson, which they never mention it by name in the article, that the state has been rapidly and quietly releasing these sex offenders from McNeil Island into communities where 1 in 4 of them go on to commit new crimes and where 1 in 9 of them or 1 in 7 of them go on to commit serious violent offenses. So the Seattle Times painted this tale of, look, whether you know it or not, the worst of the worst sex offenders have been quietly, rapidly over the last decade or so been allowed to leave McNeil Island and go into a community near you. I thought the story was good, but what I criticized the Seattle Times for at the time was not mentioning Bob Ferguson and not mentioning the fact that as Bob Ferguson campaigns for governor, he has repeatedly bragged about protecting our communities from these sexually violent predators. So here we have the current Attorney General running for governor, and one of the things he's saying over and over is, I protect your communities from sexually violent predators. Where, as the Seattle Times found out, sure, the Attorney General's office might be successful in keeping some sexually violent predators detained to McNeil Island, but there is an awful lot of them that they're not successful in keeping there, or that they're just outright not standing in the way of leaving. So this gets a little convoluted, but it's really important to understand the journalistic malpractice at play here, right? So it's the job of the Attorney General's office to deal with the civil commitment aspect of sexually violent predators. So the Attorney General's office has to petition to take a sex offender and continue to have them committed after their prison sentence. They have to convince a judge that there exists enough evidence that this person poses such a risk to reoffend that we've got to, after their prison sentence is done, put them on an island. So that's the job by law of the Attorney General's office. It is then the job of the Attorney General's office to either stand in the way of, to fight back against, or to say, we're not going to fight back against sexually violent predators who petition for release, as is their constitutional right. In the United States of America, we can't just throw someone on an island after their prison sentence is complete and say, you're never, ever going to be able to get off that island. I wouldn't want to live in a country that did that, even when we're talking about violent sex offenders. So they have a constitutional right to petition for their release from the island. It's the Attorney General's office that stands in the way of that happening and decides either we're going to fight to keep them on that island or we're not. So Bob Ferguson is out there on the campaign trail for governor saying, I protect communities from sexually violent predators, when in reality, he is just sometimes doing the basic core function of the Attorney General's office. And he never talks about all the cases they lose. He never talks about the times they've gone to court to stop a sexually violent predator from getting off McNeil Island and weren't successful. He also never talks publicly in his run for governor about all the times that they have agreed that a sexually violent predator ought to be released from McNeil Island. Like in the case of a woman who was one of the first women in the country to get a sexually violent predator designation because she repeatedly raped a baby and is thought to have dozens of victims. Well, quietly during the pandemic, she wanted to be released, and the Attorney General's office and the Department of Social and Health Services says, yeah, we think she ought to be released because we can't say for sure, and our expert can't say for sure whether she's at a risk of reoffending. Even though, like, a month into her being allowed to go on a kind of a strict supervised release, she admitted to looking at a 6-year-old girl out the window and thinking about raping a child. But yeah, so Bob Ferguson doesn't want to talk about cases like that, but he wants to make these broad, vague generalities about, I'm protecting communities from sexually violent predators. So that story happened. And then the Seattle Times story came out, and we went gung-ho on this show, all over social media, saying, wait. Bob Ferguson's bragging about protecting us. Yet this Seattle Times expose, even though they don't mention it by name, paints a very different story. So there's a clear conflict here. Now, there are a lot of controversies around Bob Ferguson that haven't stuck, that I think ought to have, like him asking the Secretary of State to break election law on his behalf. But when you are tied up as a candidate for governor in a controversy about sex offenders and about pedophiles, doesn't matter how good he is at squirming out of things. That's not something that you want following you around. So Bob Ferguson is understandably concerned. he doesn't want it to get out there and there to be widespread recognition that he is not standing in the way of the worst pedophiles ending up down the block from you and your kids. So he does what any good politician does, and by good politician, I mean corrupt politician, as most politicians are, and he decides to use the power of his office and the resources of his office to aid in his campaign for governor. Yesterday, his office put out a press release titled as follows: Attorney General's Sex Predator Unit seeks to prevent release of Whatcom County sex offender. Interesting timing, right? Interesting timing. So he's under fire for the release of all these sexually violent predators. So now they put out a press release September 3rd saying, hey, we're going to seek to prevent the release of a Whatcom County sex offender. We think he's dangerous. One of the fascinating things about this, and I'm just going to read the first couple lines for you. It says, Attorney General Bob Ferguson, remember, this is a press release from a government agency, the Attorney General's office. Attorney General Bob Ferguson filed a petition today urging a Whatcom County Superior Court judge to civilly commit a sex offender to McNeil Island, preventing his release into the community. Jake Unick, 38, was convicted in Whatcom County in 2014 of two counts of first-degree attempted kidnapping with sexual motivation, one count of first-degree kidnapping, and one count of harassment. Unick is in prison and due for release on September 5th. The Attorney General's office petitioned to have him committed, alleging he is mentally ill and dangerous. Interesting. So this sex offender, who they say is absolutely dangerous and mentally ill and might hurt people if he's released, they want him confined to an island. He's supposed to be released from prison tomorrow. You're telling me that just yesterday, the Attorney General's office decided, hey, we need to file a petition to get him sent to McNeil Island. Does that sound suspicious to you? Suspicious timing? Now, the Attorney General's office can file a petition for any sex offender. You know, they can file a petition and say, hey, we want to go to court and try to get him civilly committed. They don't have to have adequate evidence. They just go and maybe lose in court. So there's nothing stopping Attorney General Bob Ferguson from using this particular sex offender, not that I feel bad for the sex offender, but for using this particular sex offender to help his campaign and saying, hey, find me any sex offender who's about to be released from prison. Find me any sex offender and let's petition to have that sex offender civilly committed to McNeil Island. We might not be successful, but we can put out a press release today saying, hey, here's Attorney General Bob Ferguson working to protect communities from sexually violent predators. And knowing Bob Ferguson, I don't put it past him that he's using the power of his office, just picked a sex offender, the very next one who is going to be released, who did something awful, and let's just use him as a pawn. Man, I never thought I'd feel bad for a sex offender. Let's use him as a pawn and try to get him put on McNeil Island. If it doesn't work out, that's fine, but the headline's still there. So in my mind, and I would say anybody who's thinking rationally and knows how Bob Ferguson works, you see exactly what he's doing here. Weeks of negative attention about how he hasn't done anything to protect his constituents from sexually violent predators. So they all of a sudden drum up a case where they say, we're petitioning to keep this dangerous sex offender on McNeil Island. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to see what's going on here, or at least to have some very serious, relevant, fair questions about the timing of it, right? Right? So in comes Cairo 7 News. Yesterday, Cairo 7 News posted an article about this effort from the Attorney General's office to get this sex offender civilly committed to McNeil Island. The headline of the Cairo 7 story, AG files petition to civilly commit Whatcom County sex offender. So I saw that news article and I responded to Cairo 7 and I said, the timing of this is very interesting, don't you think? That this is something the AG's office would want news coverage for at a time when he's being dinged for not being very hard on the worst of the worst sex offenders. And I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I read the whole article and I thought, well, maybe they'll mention the Seattle Times reporting. Maybe they'll mention the controversy around this. Maybe they'll mention the parents who fought against these releases 2 years ago. Maybe they'll mention any aspect of this story that is relevant, especially when it comes to an attorney general who's running for governor. But they did not. In fact, as I was reading that story last night, I thought, this just reads like a press release. This whole story just reads like a press release for Bob Ferguson's campaign for governor. And it bothered me. And I was like, another example of, you know, press release reporting where there's no criticality, there's no journalism involved. The attorney general's office sends out a press release. The media just says, okay, like, we'll do a story on that, even if we know that there are other motivations for why you might be bringing this case about, why you might be putting out a press release. We're not going to question it. We're not going to use an ounce of independent thought or intellect, and we're just going to report on what you say. So I was already annoyed with it last night. But then I took time today, sitting here before the show, and I put these two things side by side. I put the press release from the Office of Attorney General next to the news article from Cairo 7. And what I realized is this wasn't just press release reporting. This was a press release reported as news. Almost every single sentence in the Cairo 7 quote-unquote news story was taken verbatim from the press release from Attorney General Bob Ferguson, the frontrunner to be the next governor of Washington State. And the differences were minute and insignificant. For instance, in the first sentence from the press release, Attorney General Bob Ferguson filed a petition today urging a Whatcom County Superior Court judge to civilly commit a sex offender. Cairo 7. They added, Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson filed a petition Tuesday. Those are the only two changes in the entire article. They changed today to Tuesday and Attorney General Bob Ferguson to Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson. And as it continued down, comparing the press release side by side with the Cairo 7 story, the same is true. It is verbatim, absolutely verbatim from the press release. Prosecutors will still have the burden to prove the allegations in court. Cairo 7. The AG's office says prosecutors will still have the burden to prove the allegations in court. AG's office. A jury verdict must be unanimous to continue to detain an individual on McNeil Island as a sexually violent predator. Cairo 7. A jury verdict must be unanimous to continue to detain an individual on McNeil Island as a sexually violent predator. AG's office. Washington's sexually violent predator law allows the state attorney general's office to petition for the civil commitment of a violent sex offender who, because of a mental abnormality or and/or personality disorder, are proven likely to engage in predatory acts of sexual violence if released. Cairo 7 News. Washington's sexually violent predator law allows the state attorney general's office to petition for the civil commitment of violent sex offenders who, because of a mental abnormality and or personality disorder, are proven likely to engage in predatory acts of sexual violence if released. I've never seen anything like it. I have never seen anything like it. And for those who are watching the show today, not listening, I'll just give you a visual. Again, the entire press release from the Attorney General's office next to the entire Cairo 7 news story. Besides maybe a couple words difference here and there, 100% of the Cairo 7 news story was taken from a government press release from the Office of Attorney General. A press release that very transparently was attempting to dig Bob Ferguson out of this scandal that he's in at a time when he is running an active campaign to be the highest elected official in the state of Washington. And Cairo 7 is doing their bidding. Hook, line, and sinker. If that does not scare the hell out of you, I don't know what will. If that does not reach the levels of, I'm going to say it, election interference, I don't know what does. You don't have to actively try to change votes, try to stop people from voting, trying to advantage yourself to be committing election interference. When you have media, and what did RFK Jr. call it? Media organs of the Democratic Party that are acting as extensions of a campaign, that is influencing elections to an extent that should never be tolerated. Now, we will reach out to Cairo 7 News. I don't know what the explanation is for this. I'm open to the possibilities. Those explanations could range from bias to laziness to low staffing, to staff members who are unqualified, to time constraints, to needing to meet deadlines. But Cairo 7 has some explaining to do in any realm, in any, at any time, election year or not. That's absolutely unacceptable. But the stakes are very high. And we are looking at failure from the media. You are propping up and acting as a propaganda arm for not only the sitting attorney general, but for the man who is the front runner to be the next governor of Washington state. It is journalistic malpractice. And it's dangerous. All right, coming up next, we're going to continue on this sort of media bender that we've been on. Wow, do I seem like sour? I'm not going to have any friends in the media after this. Nicole, will you still be my friend?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I'll be excommunicated.
You know the nice thing? Don't care. I have enough friends. I've got you.
Yeah.
I've got my dogs.
All we need.
I have my husband and my sister and like a couple other friends that I like. I'm an adult. Good. I need like five max.
Yeah. That's all we have time for, really.
Yeah. And I don't want any other jobs in mainstream news. So, you know, don't care. All right. So we'll get to our segment Unbelievable coming up next. And I'm going to share with you who is my biggest disappointment of the entire 2024 election cycle. It's not really a person. It's an entity. First, we talk all the time about what's happening globally, nationally, the presidential election that seems to be changing by the day. If you're gearing up for retirement, the question is, how do national, local, world events impact your retirement portfolio? And is your financial advisor adjusting as needed to protect you from unnecessary risk? Well, Zach Abraham is the chief investment officer at Bulwark Capital. He also hosts the Know Your Risk radio podcast. He, along with Bulwark analysts, track current events closely so they can adjust to market risks every single day to help shield your portfolio as much as possible. Risk management is Bulwark's number one focus because you only get one retirement. So check them out. Check out Zach's radio show. You can learn an awful lot from him. We do on this show. And learn about Bulwark's risk management strategy in their free Common Sense Investing Guide. Get yours right now by going to knowyourriskradio.com. knowyourriskradio.com. I also know coming up, they're going to have another one of their risk webinars that you can join. So we'll make sure to tell you about all the details when we get them from Zach. And as always, we'll have Zach on the show tomorrow to talk about all sorts of stuff. Okay. The by far biggest disappointment in the 2024 election cycle is not an individual candidate or campaign. It is the Seattle Times editorial board. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. I have no issue with people disagreeing with me. I have no issue with the Seattle Times editorial board disagreeing with me. I disagree with them often. They disagree with me. It's fine. It's healthy. Wonderful, wonderful, healthy discourse. I have no issue with them endorsing candidates I don't like Bob Ferguson. I have no issue in principle with them opposing initiatives that I support, etc. So that's not what bothers me. What bothers me is that they have abdicated their highest responsibility. They have abdicated, in the name of ideology, their greatest duty to you. And that is to hold powerful people accountable. So that is why the Seattle Times editorial board is such a disappointment to me in this very, very critical election year. Now, we've given a few examples of this before I get to the latest example. They endorsed Bob Ferguson for governor, despite the fact they called him petty, pushy, overly ambitious, and said it seems like everything he's done in his political life has been leading up to a run for the governor's office. They endorsed Bob Ferguson despite the fact that they have routinely and repeatedly knocked him for being completely lacking transparency on critical issues, racking up millions of dollars in fines for taxpayers because he's incapable of following public records laws or discovery in cases. So they have this story where they endorse him despite all of these failures, despite all the ways that he's abused his power and let down his constituents. Another example, Superintendent of Public Instruction Chris Reichdahl. The Seattle Times begrudgingly endorsed Chris Reykdal, for 4 more years as the chief of our public school system after what they characterize in the endorsement as 8 failed years. They talk about how low test scores are, how there's financial issues, how the public school system is just in utter disarray, but because the other guy's a Republican, we're going to give Chris Reykdal 4 more years, and we're going to suggest our readers vote for him. So that's what I mean, the difference between having ideological differences and allowing elected leaders, powerful people, to abuse that power, and as the media, not holding them accountable. Now, what I said the Seattle Times editorial board should have done, my expectation would be to say, look, Bob Ferguson, you know, ideologically, from a policy perspective, we might agree with him, but if we endorse him, isn't that signing off on all these bad things he's done? Isn't that signing off on his abuse of power, his lack of transparency, his lack of care or concern for public safety? So how could we do that if we're a media entity and we exist to hold the powerful accountable? Why would we take a position in that race? Ideologically, we like his ideas, but as a leader, he's let people down. The same with Chris Reykdal. They might say, ideologically, we think that he is more aligned with us, but we've already acknowledged that test scores are horrible. It says the public school system's in financial ruin because people are taking their kids out of school or they're not enrolling. So how can we reward the poor job he's done by giving him an endorsement? So that's where the Seattle Times editorial board has completely lost me. They could just as easily decide, we're not going to issue endorsements of elected leaders who have failed fundamentally at their jobs for the past 8 years, 12 years. Even if we agree with him from a policy perspective, because if we do that, then we're no good as journalists, as members of the media. Then we're, again, we are falling short of our obligation to our readership. But the Seattle Times just did the exact same thing when it comes to Initiative 2117. The Seattle Times editorial board recommends keep Washington's Climate Commitment Act, vote no on Initiative 2117. So I saw that, not necessarily a surprise, but again, they did the exact, it's the same pattern from the Bob Ferguson endorsement to the Chris Reykdal endorsement, where they acknowledge some of the lies and the deceit around the Climate Commitment Act, but they tell voters, keep it anyway. And what kind of message does that send? So a couple things I'm going to read from this endorsement. It says, waterways are warming. A statewide drought and lackluster snowpack have wreaked havoc on the state's farmers, fish populations, and even hydroelectric power generation. Ever drier forests are increasingly at risk of more frequent and intense fires. July marked the 4th consecutive month of global record high temperatures. A ballot initiative asks voters to gut the state's ambitious and necessary response to this growing crisis and prohibit any similar solution in the near future. Voters should reject the appeal. Now, here's the issue. Again, if you truly believe, which I would hope that the Seattle Times editorial board does, that their fundamental responsibility is to hold powerful people accountable, at the endorsement meeting, at the endorsement interview, when the pro and con side for Initiative 2117 sat in front of the Seattle Times editorial board, the Seattle Times editorial board asked those in favor of the CCA, do you have anything to prove that the Climate Commitment Act is actually helping the environment? Do you have any metrics, any tracking? Here's what they were told.
How are you tracking it? You know, I mean, you preserve some forest land that captures carbon. People replace their gas furnaces with heat pumps. How are you keeping track of those kind of things?
Yeah, we don't have like a system yet that sort of tallies up all of the CO2 reductions from every investment that we make. So some of the investments are, you know, we've invested in stronger air quality monitoring networks throughout the state. There's not going to be a direct greenhouse gas benefit from having more accurate information about what air quality is in South Tacoma, but it is something that our, you know, elected members of the legislature think is important.
So despite being told directly to their face, we're not tracking the potential impacts. We haven't come up with a way to do that, or we haven't implemented a way to do that. And a lot of this money is being spent on things that won't have an actual impact on emissions, which we told you on the show last week when we informed you that $14 million in the money that you were taxed at the gas pump because of the Climate Commitment Act went to climate justice initiatives, most of them in South Seattle. So the Seattle Times editorial board is told to their face, no, we're not tracking it. Yet they turn around and in their endorsement, they say, all these horrible things are happening to the climate. And this, the CCA, is the only thing that can save us. It's ambitious and necessary, despite being told to their face by the people who like the CCA that, well, actually, we can't track it. Doesn't that seem off to you? And then they go on, and I thought, well, will they call out the lies about it? Here's what they said. Governor Jay Inslee was wrong to insist the Climate Commitment Act would add pennies to the cost of gallons of gas. When prices peaked above $5 a gallon last summer as refineries passed on the cost of allowances, Haywood's initiative was born. Drivers and truckers had every reason to be peeved and concerned. Lawmakers can and should do more to relieve that pain at the pump through rebates to residents and businesses. So here's what the Seattle Times editorial board is saying. It's okay to lie to people. The ends justify the means. Think about that as a media organization saying it's okay for the highest elected official in the state to lie to people, to hurt them financially, to lie to them in the process knowingly. And we're still going to support the policy that you lied about. What message does that send Governor Jay Inslee or future governors of the state of Washington? If they want a policy bad enough, all they have to do is lie about it. And the Seattle Times will not call them out on their falsehoods. I'll just read one more passage from the Seattle Times endorsement. Well, not endorsement. It's an endorsement of the CCA, but they want you to vote no on I-2117. What are we going to do? We're going to vote yes, pay less. They said, as a draconian all-or-nothing proposition, Initiative 2117 is an inflection point. Either Washington will lead or abdicate entirely its leadership on climate change. Voters should defeat Initiative 2117. Perhaps that's where I got the word abdicate stuck in my head today. Either Washington will lead or abdicate entirely its leadership on climate change. But again, what leadership has that been? Is it leadership to implement something and then lie about the impacts to the people you serve every single day? Is that the Seattle Times editorial board's definition of leadership? If it is, then that's the problem right there, is they have a very low bar for the people who are elected to serve their constituents. Is it leadership to issue $200 bribes to energy customers to try to convince them to keep the CCA and then act like it's not a bribe at all when it very clearly is? Is that the Seattle Times editorial board's definition of leadership? I've said it a million times before. If you have to lie about a policy, the chances are it's not a good policy. But in doing this, the Seattle Times editorial board has decided to put ideology above its core responsibility to people. And say, well, you know, you can lie because you lied about something that we like. And that's a pretty dangerous precedent to set. Now, thankfully, there is someone else who writes about climate issues who has an ounce of independent thought and a brain and doesn't like or let ideology get in the way of how they view the climate industry, the industrial complex, and yeah, the very real issues related to the environment and climate. I'm talking, of course, about Cliff Mass. He's a UW climate scientist, and he issued, and I don't know if his came first or second. I actually think it came before the Seattle Times. Cliff Mass released his endorsement of Initiative 2117, saying, if you care about high energy prices, fairness to low-income residents, honesty by governmental officials, and effective approaches to dealing with global warming, you should vote yes for Initiative 2117. So Cliff was nice enough to join us today to talk about not only, you know, reacting to what the Seattle Times editorial board wrote, but to talk about his own position on the initiative. Cliff Mass, welcome back to Undivided.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I just went through the Seattle Times saying that its readers should vote no on Initiative 2117. There's a lot of things that stuck out to me in there. What did you make of it?
I didn't find it compelling, quite frankly. And I also watched the session in which the Seattle Times editorial staff talked to Hayward and to Myers about it. And I think the argument for the initiative is overwhelming.
And let's dive into that. So you, obviously, we've had you on before. You care about the climate, you know, you care about the planet. But you have seen and pointed out many times some factual inconsistencies in some of the Seattle Times' climate reporting. So when you look at 2117 and what it would do, why do you not agree with the Seattle Times that that would be detrimental to the environment to repeal CCA?
clearly the planet is warming and we're causing part of it. I mean, I'm not going to argue with that. I've done a lot of research on this topic. But actually, the effects are relatively subtle. And the Seattle Times has a history of, let's say, hyping and exaggerating the effects. So we start off with some of the claims of these over-the-top effects of climate change, and that's why we have to act so quickly. A lot of those are just not correct and can be proven to be incorrect. So we start with that. Then we have the issue is that this is a very regressive tax and that, low-income people are hurt the most. So I mean, that's another issue. There's the issue that people have been deceived by some of the statements of some political leaders, suggesting that this would only raise the gas prices by pennies when it actually went up 40 to 50 cents. And then there's the issue that there's the money is going all kinds of places, and most of them are not going to do much for reining in emissions. It's just not there. And there's no part of this CCA that keeps track of what progress we're making, what positive impact do all these programs make. There's no way to track it. There's no way to evaluate it. So I think there's just one weakness after the other for the CCA, and I think this initiative is doing good work.
Yeah, so to be clear, you are voting yes on Initiative 2117.
Yes, I will vote yes on this. Yes.
Some of the complaints you have about the Climate Commitment Act, the Seattle Times actually points out in the article, Governor Inslee lying, although they didn't call it a lie, it was a lie, about gas prices, for instance. But they are making the argument that we must, in spite of those shortfalls, the impact on gas prices, et cetera, we have to support the Climate Commitment Act because if we pass the initiative, then the legislature will be completely hamstrung from dealing with climate issues in the future. Respond to that.
Well, I don't see why that's the case. I mean, the legislature could have worked on a number of areas that deal with changes in climate and environmental issues. I mean, a good example is the forests. The people are upset about smoke and fires. But the truth is, the main issue is on the ground, that we've mismanaged our forests for the last 40, 50 years. Invasive grasses are moving in, people are igniting the fires. So the real issues really aren't climate ones. And the legislature could have dealt with this. The governor could have dealt with this a long time ago, and he hasn't, and they haven't.
On that point you made earlier about there's no, and this was, I think, to me, one of the aspects of the Seattle Times Ed Board actual interview that you're able to watch that stood out to me. They're making these, and I'm just going to read part of this. This is the Seattle Times editorial, talking about waterways are warming, a statewide drought and lackluster snowpack have wreaked havoc on farmers, fish populations, da 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 da. And it says, a ballot initiative asks voters to gut the state's ambitious and necessary response to this growing crisis and prohibit any similar solution in the near future. I guess what I struggle with, and I think you alluded to it, is they're saying, we have to keep the Climate Commitment Act because of all these environmental issues. But there is no system built into this that tracks outcomes. So I guess how can they make the case that this is essential for our climate if they have no way or are implementing no way to track it?
Well, it's even worse than that. If you want to see what has been the emissions of CO2 by our state, you would think that that would be really important to keep track and keep it up to date. Well, go to the Department of Ecology site, and the numbers end in 2019. So for 5 years, they haven't updated what the emissions have been. So it's amazing. If they were serious about emissions, if they were really worried about emissions, first, they'd find out in real, almost in real time, what we're doing. They're not doing that. And then you'd have the ability to see what the implications of these various programs that they're funding, how much is each of them contributing to reducing emissions? They're not tracking that at all. So they're not serious about it.
Yeah, they want
That's
the money. They don't want to track the outcomes because they don't want to be responsible if the outcomes fall short. Somebody brought up this issue of the emissions not being posted since pre-pandemic. Do you know what is stalling them?
I have no idea why it stalled. But let's face it, if you're serious about climate change and CO2 emissions, you'd be keeping track of this, okay? And they're not.
Yeah. So, Cliff Mass, make your best pitch to people who, in my estimation, are being fed a lot of lies about the CCA, about the initiative. Make your best pitch for people who are on the fence about how to vote on 2117.
Well, if you care about climate change, you want effective approaches to deal with it. And clearly, this is not it. I mean, there's all kinds of ways of dealing with climate change if you were and environmental issues. If you care about the forests, well, you want to work on restoring them to what they were like. Okay, we're hardly doing any of that. If you want to deal with climate change, you need to keep track of what's going on. We're not doing that either. If you want to deal with climate change, you need to know exactly what's going on, and you need truthful information about what the impacts have been of the minor warming. They're not doing that. They're exaggerating things. You need to move to technologies that could actually help, such as nuclear power. And that's there. We're hardly going anywhere there. Finally, you want to be equitable in the sense that you don't want to penalize poor people, preferentially. And they're certainly doing that. So I think people who are on the edge, who worry about the environment and care about the truth, there's good reason not to support what's going on now, and therefore to support the initiative.
Yeah. I want to end with this because I asked the question of someone else on a few weeks ago on the show, and I want to ask it of you too. Governor Inslee's coming to the end of his time in office. Will be done with his tenure in January, and he has been the climate governor. He's the climate presidential candidate. Do you believe there'll be a shift in the eagerness to pursue some of these environmental policies when he's out of office, regardless of who replaces him?
Well, I can't answer that, of course, but let's face it, he did make us a centerpiece. And let's face I look at this as a great tragedy. He cares about climate change, there's no doubt about that, but he has not been effective in dealing with environmental issues, in dealing with the forests, in dealing with potential ways of dealing with climate change. So it's really quite unfortunate that he cares so much. And he's been so ineffective in just this area.
Yeah, wasted time. All right, Cliff Mass, we appreciate your time and expertise per the usual. Thanks so much.
It was my pleasure.
I think one of the reasons Cliff Mass is such an important voice on this is because he's dedicated his career to understanding the climate, environmental impacts, and all of that. Like, he's not a climate change denier. He likes to look at things with facts and reason and make sure that there is actual data to back up the arguments that he's making. And oftentimes, we've had him on the show before to point out that things the Seattle Times is reporting on are either just steeped in hyperbole or just factually wrong. And so I think it's significant for someone like Cliff Mass to say this major climate proposal of Governor Inslee's legacy should be repealed. And so he's supporting the repeal, and he is going to, as are we, vote yes, pay less on all the initiatives, not just Initiative 2117. All right, coming up next, we're going to talk about something. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of this. I don't know why this whole idea just kind of cracks me up, but something called co-living and whether it could be a solution to Washington State's housing shortage. But first, if you are in the market perhaps to sell your home, I've heard from several people, it always bums me out on Facebook. They're saying, I'm moving to so-and-so, I'm moving to Texas. And I'm like, please just wait till after November. Please don't abandon us yet. But if you're planning to abandon us and you're planning to sell your home, check out a few real estate agents. Don't select one until you've talked to our friend Wes Jones with sellwithwes.com. Wes does something called the Listing Boost Concierge Service, where look, if you need to make some cosmetic updates to your home, just to make sure it shows better, but you're like, I don't have the money to do that. So that's why you're putting off selling your home. Have no fear. Wes Jones can front you the money. He fronted Sharona Rhodes and her husband $10,000 to make needed repairs. And Sharona said, gosh, we were happy about that. But you need to pay it back after closing. And so we just hoped that $10,000 that he put in, we were going to get that out of the upgrades when the house sold.
It was a little scary, but he sent us weekly, I think, reports on how home sales were going in our area. So we knew we were on the right track. And so, my husband and I are not big on debt.
Good.
But, you know, we had to be in debt to get the things done that we needed done. So it was just a lot of praying, like, Lord, just please let this happen. And then trusting that Wes knew exactly what he was talking about and that he would come through in the end, which he did.
Yeah. And even in this housing market, Wes was able to get their home sold for over list price in 6 days. So that $10,000 investment he fronted them on the front end was really worth it. So check out our friend Wes Jones, sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, let's talk about co-living. So obviously there is a housing, I don't deny that there's a housing crisis in Washington State, and on many different levels. You know, there's the affordable housing crisis, and I look at that in two different ways. I look at like workforce housing and people who have a full-time job, maybe they have two incomes in their home and they can't afford to buy a freaking house in the state that they live in. And then you look at affordable housing in the sense I think most people think about it, which is people who are on the cusp of homelessness, very low income, maybe they are homeless and are trying to get out of homelessness. And so you look at like affordable housing in that sense. But there was a bill passed already in the legislature, and it was actually passed on a bipartisan basis, which is why I want to talk about it today, because we don't see that often in this housing debate. There's a lot of disagreement about how we go about fixing it. But what it allows for are more what are called co-living spaces. And I'm going to talk to Sean Flynn with the Rental Housing Association of Washington more about what that means. But essentially, it's a way for cities to be able to increase the density within an individual unit. And think of it kind of like a dormitory where you've got, you know, really small living spaces, and then you have some shared co-living spaces like shared kitchens, shared bathrooms, shared laundry, things like that. So Sean Flynn with RHA, who we talk to every week on the show, joined us to react to the latest in this. So the bill was already passed in Olympia, again, on a bipartisan basis, but now cities are trying to implement it. Sean Flynn, welcome back to Undivided.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we talk a lot about disagreement, about bad housing policy. Let's talk about something that has bipartisan support, shall we?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it doesn't happen often, but we've got one on this topic.
Well, you know, I'm all kumbaya. This is called Undivided. I'm never mad about anything. I think everything's great. But let's talk about co-living. So before we even get to the bill, what does co-living mean?
Well, co-living is a bill that was passed through the legislature last year that allowed for it. And then I think Seattle City Council is looking at adopting another ordinance that would work, I guess, would dovetail with the statewide bill. And co-living allows for smaller units, oftentimes in people's homes, but not necessarily always in people's homes. And so it's a really great way to provide affordable housing for folks that maybe don't need an entire house all to themselves.
So we're not talking about, I mean, this isn't like roommates. I mean, roommates are co-living. This is like individual, so like shared bathrooms, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is not a roommate. So you can always have a roommate. So if you want to get a roommate to move in to your house or apartment, that's not really what co-living is. Sometimes in the past, we called them CDUs, which is single occupancy dwelling unit, or micros. Sometimes they were called micros. And then they fell out of favor, mostly with the folks who didn't like them being developed in their neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. Sort of the anti-density folks pushed a movement to kill those units. And so we're seeing the resurgence of those smaller units that we're going to allow to be permitted and built hopefully throughout the state, because what it does is it allows for folks who are looking for a different type of living environment that they can afford to be built at a much cheaper rate, and that will be then affordable in the marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a hostel, like if you're going to travel abroad or something. So is that kind of what differentiates it from like a tiny apartment, right? Because I had a friend who like had a tiny apartment back when we were younger, and this thing was like, I swear to God, it was 75 square feet. It was so small. That might be exaggerating, but it did have a bathroom. It did have an oven. So is the difference here the shared space?
Yeah, the difference here is going to be a shared space. And it's taking that these units will take the place that CDUs used to occupy in the marketplace. So for a while we were building CDUs. We don't do those anymore, really. And now we have a chance to have more shared housing situations like this, where you've got multiple folks with private space, but also a communal space such as a kitchen and a bathroom and all of that.
Yeah, it's almost like a dormitory or something. I guess why didn't they have it before? Why was this not allowed?
So once upon a time, like, they used to call these rooming houses or boarding houses in like the 20s and 30s, right? And then we saw a push for single family residencies to really dominate the housing code and exclude other types of housing. When my grandparents came out to Seattle during the Depression, they both lived in a rooming house. And this was not an uncommon thing for folks to have a shared living space and a shared bathroom. But as you saw the single family zone take over the housing code, it excluded lots of different types of housing, from apartment buildings to rooming houses to commercial even as well. And so that's why we have whole swaths of our state that are only zoned single family. And this bill, both the state bill and Seattle's bill, attempts to start to eat away at that traditional exclusionary zoning that we've had.
Yeah, and this bill was co-sponsored by Rep. Andrew Bark as a Republican and Rep. Mia Gregerson, a Democrat. So we know that maybe this is something that, you know, can be agreed on in this whole housing, lack of housing, affordability issue. Who do you foresee as being the possible tenants in these co-living situations?
Oh, you could see anyone from students to folks who don't have a large family, who don't need the extra space. And also depends on where they are, right? I mean, some people will, in a good housing market, you have consumers that have choices, right? You may not need a two-bedroom or a single open one-bedroom apartment if you don't value that space, right? If you live out in the city more and being downtown or near an amenity is more important to you, then maybe you make the choice to live in an environment like that. So you can have anyone from young working professionals to students to retired folks who want to maybe have a 6-month lease in the city of Seattle and then move on to a different part of the world to experience. I mean, it really opens up a wide array of folks who could live there.
All right. It's interesting, Sean. This might be the one and only time that we just, you know, talk about something not everybody, but a lot of people agree on. So we appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, and I don't really see the problem with it. I guess if you need to, you know, one of my only issues is I think that, you know, for the homeless, for instance, or low income, there are these efforts to buy up like hotels and other things and they're empty. And it's like, okay, is the issue really that we don't have enough of affordable housing, or is it that we can't get people in a stable place to be able to live in these units? But for something like co-living, I can see a lot of individuals who'd benefit from that, who aren't homeless, you know, who can afford a place to live, you know, close to where they work, but who don't need that much space, maybe aren't there that often. So any efforts, frankly, within reason to be able to increase the housing supply and the type of housing, I'm glad to see there's bipartisan support for that. So that segment was brought to you in partnership with our friends at the Rental Housing Association of Washington. If you are a landlord in the state, a small to mid-sized landlord, you need to be a member of RHA. It's like $260 a year, and they can help you navigate this insane environment that landlords are in right now. So rhawa.org, rhawa.org. All right, I have talked about my success. Here, first of all, for all of you who are like, Brandy, I would do the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program, but I'm not going to do it during the summer. Nicole, is it summer still? The pumpkin spice lattes are out, which is a sure sign that fall is here. So now there's no excuses. I did the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program like almost exactly 2 years ago. I started it, well, I think I actually started it November 1st, 2 years ago. But I was like, man, you know, I wish I had started a little earlier in the fall because I was worried about butting up against the holidays, but I just did it anyway. I lost 30 pounds in 60 days and I'm down 40 pounds total. So you can change your life in a very short period of time. And I've been able to keep the weight off for 2 years because it's not a magic trick. There's no drugs, no injections. There's no like quick tricks or prepackaged meals. They teach you what to eat in the right portions. And then they teach you how to make some lifestyle changes so you can keep the weight off for life or easily get back on track if you've got a vacation where you go off the rails a little bit for 2 weeks. So highly recommend. This is the time of year to do it. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. Schedule your free 15-minute consultation today. All right, let's fit in some nationals, shall we? And then Nicole put a little, it says, another one bites the dust, down, and another one's down, and another one. Another company is getting rid of DEI. This time, Coors, which is these companies, that get rid of it. It's like the ones you never expected would have it in the first place. But then we didn't think Bud Light would hire who they hired to be a spokesperson for their brand. So it's just strange. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Molson Coors rolls back DEI initiatives. The maker of Coors Light said it would no longer participate in a benchmark by the Human Rights Campaign to measure LGBTQ plus inclusion. Because apparently they were concerned with whether the Human Rights Campaign found them to be woke enough. But now they're not concerned anymore. It says the brewer said it would no longer participate in a scoring system by the Human Rights Campaign, an advocacy group that gives scores to companies based on LGBTQ plus inclusion in their workplace. In addition, Molson Coors said it would no longer have supplier diversity goals, which typically aim to buy supplies from companies owned by minorities or women. They said the human resources team has been working on changing its culture since March to evolve from, quote, our work focused on DEI to a broader view in which all our employees know they are welcome. The driving force behind the shift, the email said, was the understanding that when all our people know they are welcome, they are more engaged, motivated, and committed to our company's collective success. And I think there are some of these DEI efforts that maybe Coors and other companies are realizing make some of your employees, namely white employees, feel like they're not welcome. You know, some of their suppliers, like you might have a supplier who happens to be white, has a great business, is perfectly positioned to be part of your supply chain, but because of the skin pigmentation, you're choosing someone else? Like, how is that? It goes back to, how is that inclusive? How is that like equality? How is that accepting? It's not. So look, you know, I think that there are in business always ways where you can say, what's a community that's not in this business? And that, you know, should be, that there's no reason they shouldn't be. And what can we do to help them out, but without putting other people down? And that's kind of the equity part of it, right? Everybody's on the same footing. And if that means we have to shove you down to pick someone up, then so be it. That's ridiculous. And it also feeds into this. I say it all the time on Washington State and Seattle DEI efforts. It's like most progressive place in America. And our state leaders treat us as if we're racists. And we have to be forced into these DEI initiatives because we can't be good people on our own. We can't be, you know, we must be racist unless the government trains it out of us. It's just stupid. All right, let's get to our daily subscriber show poll because 6 days from debate night, not only in America, debate night in Washington State. I'm so excited. So we're going to have, unless somebody drops out, the first Trump-Harris debate. And then immediately following that is going to be the first debate between Dave Reichert and Bob Ferguson. So, you know, I don't know how much faith I have in the ability of these debates. I think the presidential one's ABC, right?
I'm not positive.
And then NBC, the King 5, is having the Reichert-Ferguson debate. I want to say it's ABC. Could be wrong. Somebody will tell me in the comments. Look, I know a lot, but I don't know everything. I keep a lot in this noodle.
September 10th on ABC.
ABC, okay. See? So I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll on Patreon, Locals, and X, which debate are you most interested in watching? Now, I know a lot of you will watch both, but that's not the question. So if anybody in there says both, I'm not reading your comment today. You have to choose. September 10th debate between Trump and Harris, or the September 10th debate between Reichert and Ferguson. I knew you guys cared more about the gubernatorial debate. I mean, yes, I am excited for both of them. But it's interesting, depending on the platform, over on X right now, more people are saying Trump Harris. On Patreon and Locals, more people are saying Reichert Ferguson. Christopher says, I'll watch them both, but I fear the Trump Harris one will be more of a train wreck, which makes it less appealing to me than the debate for governor. It's almost like the networks want it to be a train wreck because they, like, you know, they get so much more ratings out of that. I do think local debates are less of a crazy situation typically. Weisscastle says, since neither is likely to change my vote, gotta go with the most entertaining. Trump versus Harris is the thriller in Manila. Todd Brisky, choose Trump Harris. I chose Trump Harris only because it will be a bigger spectacle. However, since there is zero chance that Harris will not win Washington's electoral votes, it's actually less important for me personally. I think that's a very good point. Let me see here. Megan, it's so hard to choose because they are equally as important to me, but I choose Wa State Governor because I had to follow the rules and vote one or the other. Thank you, Megan. I'm glad somebody appreciates my rules. You know, because when we first started doing these polls, somebody said, you can't give like both as an option because that's a cop-out. Remember that? So yes. I was like, okay, we won't give people cop-out answers.
Yep.
Let me see. Shirley says, I'll watch them both, but I've heard so little from Reichert that it's more important to me. Let me do one more. No, I'm not reading ones that say I'm only doing both, Brandy. Morgan B., I think the biggest impact to me is going to be the local debate, considering the worsening conditions of our state. I have to agree. I'm excited for both. So can I just think out loud here for a second, Nicole?
You may.
Okay. So here's the deal that I'm, here's the quandary in my little brain. Have you scheduled vacation for when I'm on vacation?
Yes.
That might factor into it. So Mike and I take like one absolute trip every year around this time, and it's to Vegas. That's all we do. We go with our friends to Vegas, and it's planned long in advance, okay? So next week on the 11th, a week from today, Mike and I are going to Vegas. And so it's really poor timing because both the debates are that night. So I'm just spitballing here. You don't have to commit to anything, Nicole. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking maybe we do a live little show after the debates, which will be like 9 p.m. Mm-hmm. Or we do an early morning show the next day. I'm inclined to do late night so we can just both mm-hmm. go on our vacation. Mike and I's flight leaves like early afternoon, so it wouldn't be the end of the world. Same. So that's what I've been noodling. I don't want to leave our friends high and dry after such an important occasion. Mm-hmm. She's like, why would you bring this up on the air? I asked you if I could. I said, can I speak? You just said yes, not knowing what the topic was. Okay, Nicole and I will catch
up. I'm just trying to figure out what we take from it. So yeah, we'll have to do some brainstorming on it, how it would be designed, I guess.
Yeah, we'll figure something out, even if it's, I don't know. So I want you to know, I didn't mm-hmm. want to break your hearts, but we're going to noodle it, see what we can, if we can, what we can,
okay,
how we can. Nicole's okay. Like, I hate my life and I hate my job and I hate everything about this place. No,
I mean, it could work. So it could work.
It could work. I just, okay. it just was a really inopportune time. All right. Mm-hmm. So we'll discuss that mm-hmm. amongst ourselves and we'll let you know. But I just wanted you to know that I was thinking about it. Okay. Natchez RV Resort. If you've got an RV and you're like, where do I park this thing? Park it at a high class resort, and Natchez RV Resort is it. You have, first of all, 300 days of sunshine over there. So now about this time of year when we all started getting depressed under the clouds, you could have it parked over there. It could be your getaway, home away from home. They've got tennis courts, pickleball courts. They're working on their pool and their hot tub. They just opened their 4,300 square foot clubhouse. So imagine that. You have friends come to visit you. You know, you've got your RV there, but you have all this space and just luxury gourmet kitchen. You got a gym and all this where people can just hang out and chill. And there's just a ton of year-round family fun, fishing, hunting, snow skiing, golf, river rafting, outstanding wine tasting, all just minutes away from the resort. So right now they do have some extra large RV lots that have become available. They start at just $79,900. And they also have a program where you can rent out your space when you're not using it. So you can kind of use it as a source of income for you and your family. So NatchezRVResort.com, NatchezRVResort.com. All right, let's get to some comments. Nicole's over there smiling. Why are you smiling?
Oh, I just put in one comment that I'm excited for you to read.
All right, let's see if I find out which one. Baron of Gray Matter with some super chats. Wrong. Obama approved the use of propaganda against the American public. The left and mainstream media has run with it ever since. Look it up. I'll have to look it up. Mm-hmm. The Seattle Times is failing. Look up their subscribers. Look at their online subscribers. The money they get is from lefty loons who they gaslight for, normies believe. And then you were talking about the, I'm just reading these as a super chat. The, what are they called? Co-living housing. Mm-hmm. Sorry, no, this is part two of a bill that passed along allowing ADUs and rezoning for multifamily housing in suburban neighborhoods. Just no bad idea. I'm interested to hear more. Greg Olake is Brandy. You need to get Reichdahl back on the show and grill him on all his failures. We invited Chris Reichdahl back on the show for an election interview and he declined. He declined, which we were shocked by because he always says yes.
Right.
It might be something to do with me losing my ever-loving mind that the Seattle Times endorsed him despite failures.
I still thanked him for always being willing to chat with us normally. Yeah. And that this was a more campaign-related request. And so I can see how he can choose not as a
yeah, there's more leeway there. As the superintendent, he definitely has agreed to do interviews that most wouldn't. I used to do interviews at Dory all the time. Maybe he'll still do interviews with us in his capacity as the superintendent mm-hmm. outside the election. Nightwolf, I believe that with a Bob administration, even if the CCA is overturned, Bob will find a way to bring it back. I agree. Mm-hmm. Buzz Brown, Democrats' typical MO, create a crisis, tax it, skim the money, fix nothing, raise taxes again, create a new crisis, rinse, repeat. Yep, homeless industrial complex, climate industrial complex, drug industrial complex, you name it. Sandy Johnson Fleck, thank you for having Cliff on. It's refreshing to be informed with a rational, honest voice. I agree. We love Cliff. Dean Wade, if they, hi, buddy, if they really needed the money, they wouldn't be giving it away. Yeah. If so, you got $14 million exactly. to give to organizations who have never done, some of them, any climate-related work, but because they serve some sort of BIPOC group, they just get a gift of your money for climate justice. What the hell is climate justice? What is it? What's climate justice? And why is it worth millions of dollars? Give me a break. You guys have lost your minds.
I just got another email about some of the spending I'm going to look into from the CCA
yes.
and how appropriate it is.
And so. I have a PDR out on the thing we talked about last week. So TZ Burton, Vancouver, BC has a separate court system for tenant-landlord disputes. You go before a judge. Both sides present their side. And the judge decides. Mostly renters don't show and are evicted. Well, wouldn't that be nice? I mean, technically, we have a court process as well. It's just very, very backed up.
Crazy.
All right. With that, we have a fun sanity check for today. So let's get to our closing sanity check. So you've probably seen this all over social media, but I have answers for you. So I think it started just originally with a woman who had asked her Amazon Alexa about who to vote for in the presidential race. Initially, I saw the video I'm about to play and I thought maybe this is like fake. Maybe she's, you know, dubbing the audio. But then people were posting their videos asking their Amazon Alexas the same thing and getting the same response. So here it is.
Alexa, why should I vote for Donald Trump?
I cannot provide content that promotes a specific political party or a specific candidate.
Alexa, why should I vote for Kamala Harris?
While there are many reasons to vote for Kamala Harris, the most significant may be that she is a strong candidate with a proven track record of accomplishment. As the first female vice president, Harris has already broken down a major gender barrier, and her career in politics has been characterized by a commitment to progressive ideals and a focus on helping disenfranchised communities.
That's crazy. I think initially I thought it was AI because that chick has such an intense photo filter on. I was like, is that a real person?
Maybe some tanning.
Maybe. But anyway, that's wild. Like, I am not allowed to give opinions when asked about Trump, and then Harris has broken barriers, and it's like, holy smokes. So anyway, this went out. A bunch of people were doing it. Amazon obviously fixed it pretty quick because our own producer, Nicole, has an Amazon Alexa. And was it last night or this morning you taped this?
This morning.
This morning she taped asking the same questions. Here's what her Alexa told her.
Alexa, why should I vote for Trump?
Quite frankly, I don't think bots should influence elections.
Alexa, why should I vote for Harris?
I cannot provide content that promotes a specific political party or a specific candidate.
So it's still slightly different, but obviously it was fixed. So I reached out to Amazon this morning. I got a prompt response. Their statement, this was an error that was quickly fixed. But then they provided me some background, which I thought was funny. They said they wanted me to know that Alexa doesn't have political opinions. Do you think that I think that Alexa has political opinions? Come on. Amazon, you know me. I'm a smart lady. You know, not to brag, but I think I'm fairly intelligent and intuitive, really. I don't think Alexa herself as a being has formed political opinions about Donald Trump. I think that the AI prompts that have been put into her produce those results, which are clearly biased results. So the individuals who worked on Alexa, I believe, were biased and for whatever reason decided that they wanted to do this. It says, you know, they also say that they're always updating and auditing their systems to detect and block content that violates their policies, and they have teams dedicated to preventing similar things in the future. This was a human cause thing. Like, come on. Alexa doesn't just all of a sudden be like, can't tell you for Trump, but here's all this, like, waxes poetic about Kamala Harris. So I would love to hear Amazon say, yeah, one of our guys who works with the AI did this, and they're like big Kamala fans, and they have TDS, and we fired them, and we fixed it. Like, is that so hard to say?
Apparently,
Alexa doesn't have political opinions. Oh, you don't say. Wow, learned something new today. That has been our sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to... Alexa doesn't have political opinions. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We appreciate you. If you have not subscribed to support the show already, please do so. We're the only ones fact-checking anything. Really? There's like... almost no one doing their jobs in the Seattle media. So hell, throw us $5 a month. We'll pick up the slack for them. UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com. We'll see you back here on the live show tomorrow at noon.